Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Hey, this is Jimmy Carboni. This is our 14th year. We're at Beer Sessions Radio, and we are here today in the studio at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. We've been here now, I think in 2009, the Heritage Radio Network opened up, and it's so great to be back here. Big thanks to Brandon Hoy and Roberta's Pizza for hosting our studio. And Armin Spengen, our engineer today, and we've got two guests. So guys, let's introduce yourselves.
I'm Brett Taylor, co-founder and head brewer at Wild East Brewing Company.
I'm Ted Kenny, owner of Top Hops Beer Shops.
So when I'm in the studio in Roberta's, it's always a chance to bring in some of my favorites from the New York City beer community. Aww. So we're going to dive into beer. And Brett, you know, Brett is at Wild East. He's one of those guys that worked his way up from being a home brewer, winning awards. And the last time I was at Wild East Brewing, you guys had a pre-opening party. It was one of Josh Bernstein's books. September, so welcome, man. I'm getting to finally try your beer.
September 2019 was and here we are, September whatever. What year is 2023?
Yeah.
What a wild, crazy journey it's been to get to here.
Nothing happened between those two.
And Ted, you know, I mean, we've all heard about Wild East. I've had some good bottles along the way. But it's just nice to sit with you. And I know how busy you are because a couple of times I tried to get you in last minute. And so you're the brewer. You're brewing. And let's talk about that role you have, because, you know, we hear so much about every brewery is different. Don't you think so, Ted? It's like they're not cookie cutter. And that's what we like about it. So, like, let's talk about a couple of your main styles and what you started with and where you are now.
Yeah, I mean, we wrote this business plan in 2016, 2017, and it was a very different world than we expected to move the majority of our beer through our tap room. We expected to make a lot of hazy IPA, and you know, obviously the farmhouse side of things was a big part of what we were going to do, and it still is. But we had to roll with the punches, not really getting our first beer in the tanks until late 2019, and then getting into the market in 2020, early 2020. We were still, our tap room was supposed to be finishing construction around the beginning of April 2020. And obviously you all know what happened. So, you know, we went on the day of lockdown, we went from 100% distribution to 100% to go, and we're a brewery that nobody ever heard of. We weren't even canning yet. We're selling crowlers out the door. It was bleak. What kept us going was the fact that we hadn't actually closed out all of our loans yet, and we were still in the bank was still paying our bills for us. So we were able to sort of like skate through the hardest part of that. But yeah, we did not. You know, we thought we were going to, like I said, make a lot of hazy IPA and farmhouse beer. And I kind of wanted to be like a modern interpretation of, you know, of Russian River, sort of. That was always sort of in the back of my mind, what I was trying to emulate. And as it happened, we're one of the most prolific brewers of decocted Czech style lager on the East Coast of the United States. You know, who knew? You go where you go. So.
Oh, Ted. Ted, in your words, tell us what the myth of Wild East is, because when I see Wild East, I want it.
Yeah, but this strikes me kind of funny, because I didn't realize that they had foreseen themselves doing a lot of hazy IPAs Wild yeast. I mean, obviously, wild yeast, it goes hand in hand.
Right.
But I've gotten to know wild yeast from the Czech Pilsners and the easy drinking, very approachable, great beers that you guys make. And I am so glad that you didn't go the hazy IPA route, because we've already got guys that are doing hazy IPAs.
Yeah.
And I love when people come in and they're, looking to discover different styles of beer and rediscover, the great beers that are out there. And not just, there's other things besides hazy doubles and.
For sure. I mean, as it happened, we've gotten to the point now where we make a half batch of hazy IPA basically every other month for our tap room and for Lucky 13, the heavy metal bar directly across the street. That's who gets it. If you ask for it, you can get it out at accounts, but we don't put it on the mailer. It's really taken a backseat to other beers. I got a lot of gray hair here. I grew up making West Coast IPA, and it's really where my heart is when it comes to hoppy beer. I like it to be bitter and clear and have a bright, punchy dry hop on it. We sell a lot more of that, and people want that from us. So we still make a lot of IPA. It's not what our neighbors, and you can walk to Three's, Finback another half within 20 minutes, and they all make, remarkable, and mostly world class hazy beer. And I'm not trying to compete with that. So that made a lot of sense.
Yeah. Let's go back to the Czech style Pilsner.
Yeah.
Tell us what steps to go through to make it the double decoction.
Yeah.
I know what it is, but it still sounds sexy.
Yeah, it's hot. Yeah. In our anniversary beer, we're making for the second year in a row now. It's called, this is Patience and Fortitude that we're drinking now. It's our flagship, Pilsner. It's a double decocted Czech style, 12 Plato Pilsner. And all that adds up to, if you ever hear the term premium Pilsner, this would be a Czech style premium Pilsner as opposed to like a lighter Pilsner. It's 4.8%, 4.8%. Basically decoction means we take a portion of the mash and we boil it. And what happens there is it creates a lot of color. It creates a lot of Maillard reactions you would get in cooking, and a lot of kettle caramelization that leads to body mouthfeel and a touch of residual sweetness, which is offset by a big burst of the Sots hops. All of our ingredients in this beer are sourced from the Czech Republic. And as it happens, New York City water is very close on a sort of molecular level to the water in Pilsen. So it was very natural that to make that beer with what we have here as far as water goes. And also just happens to be my favorite style of Pilsner. I like that sort of robust character. And we've gone very far down the Czech rabbit hole. We were the only American brewery to be invited to pour it at Prague Beer Fest this year. And while we were there, we just
wow, that's awesome.
We nerded out. We went and got certified as tapsters. We have three certified tapsters. We were all trained by last year's national champion tapster in the Czech Republic. And so we pride ourselves on providing a very traditional and genuine sort of Czech experience when you get our beers. We're very serious about the pour, the glassware. Especially on Tuesdays, our bartender Robin Fowler is—he's such a student of the game, and he makes sure that everything is on point. It's not so busy like a Saturday or Sunday, and you can get this super perfect treatment of the beer.
Ted, what's your feeling about side pours, and you know, you got first tell us about where Top Hops is at, because when I met you, you had opened on Orchard Street, and then you opened at Essex Market, mm-hmm. and you're a great retailer, one of the top beer retailers that I know, and you know everything.
Definitely.
So let's talk about Czech style pills, but side pours and all the fun stuff.
Well, when he was talking, that was what was going through my mind. Is I have a tap that's a side pour, but I don't have it hooked up at Essex right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I gotta get on that. I gotta get this done, because it does make a difference in the beer and how you present the beer and how the beer
definitely yeah.
And it's really looks awesome. It's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so that was going through my mind then, like, okay, where is that tap? Where is that faucet? And okay, I've got to get this done.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jimmy. We're located in the Essex Market, which is Essex and Delancey on the Lower East Side, on the Manhattan side of the Williamsburg Bridge. And we're on the ground floor, just above the stairway that goes down to Market Line, which has another great beer bar there called the Grand Delancey.
Grand Delancey, yeah.
So we're right upstairs from the Grand Delancey, and we're on the ground floor. And we're, as my original place was, we are a bottle shop and craft beer bar. We had to scale back, and because of a much smaller footprint, we had to scale back, and now we only have about 125 to 150 beers in bottles and cans. Most of them are available cold, and we have 6 tap lines. Now that's scaled back from our flagship on Orchard Street, which we unfortunately had to close during COVID, which had 20 draft lines and 800 to 850 different bottles and cans. So we scaling back to 120 was difficult.
So. Well, you know what I love about this show, because I've got a brewer who I've known for years whose beers keep getting better, and a retailer who came from the beer industry, and this is pretty cool. One thing about your shop at Essex Market, I remember when you were first opening it, you had checked out our friends at the Bronx Beer Hall, mm-hmm. at Arthur Avenue. Just tell us about those inspirations, because you guys are in the middle of a market. Kind of like being in the supermarket and serving beer, right?
It definitely is. It's a unique situation. And they've been doing it up by Arthur Avenue for a number of years. And we opened up in the old Essex Market as just a bottle shop back in 2015, which is, I think, the time that they opened up in the Bronx. It was right around there. We opened up right around the same time. Now, that market is another one of these New York City markets that had been set up back in Fiorello LaGuardia set them up. And so the one, there's only a few of them that are still, I think they're only...
Yeah, 1930s. Yeah, Arthur Avenue Market, yeah. Essex Market.
And they're only... Mm-hmm. I think they're only
Essex
still
Street Market.
A few that are still operating. And so we're... You know, it was... When they closed the old Essex Market and they opened up the new Essex Market across the street, and we were able to incorporate the on-premise experience like they do up in the Bronx... at Essex Market, and it's a 50,000 square foot market with 40 vendors. There's 3 greengrocers, there's a fish store, a butcher, there's 3 cheese places, there's 2 bakeries, one for sweets, one for breads and muffins and stuff like that. There's about a dozen ready-to-eat vendors, and there's a Shopsins.
Shopsins, there's the taco Mexican bakery.
Well, no, Shopsins is that crazy diner that was that was highlighted on one of the Food Network places, and they've got a very eclectic menu, and it's a very cool spot. Only open, you know, irregular hours. And there's Fromage Essex is a great cheese shop that's got a great gourmet selection. And so there's a lot of things. There's Peruvian food. There's German, what do you call it? The kebab, the German kebabs. There's a pizza place. There's an Italian food place with people from Rome. There's a Japanese deli, Dominican, tacos. I mean, it's got everything you could ever want. Yeah. It's a phenomenal market.
No, you got to go and drink beer.
Yeah, and then go grab your beer or go grab your food and come back and sit at the bar and have some great beers. Wow. Hopefully we'll have something from Wild East on tap. We'll definitely have some stuff in the coolers.
Yeah. Let's go back to Wild East. So just to focus you, let's talk about the beer that we're drinking, this the double decoction Czech pills. And you know, when you explain that you boil it down, honestly, I like the way you explained it.
Yeah.
Because sometimes brewers talk and I don't understand them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a very old school way of doing the mash. The Germans kind of started it, and I think they've kind of moved on from that because they're very much about technology. I think maybe 50-50, but I'm making that number up. It's not as common for German lager brewers to do a decoction mash anymore. And boil part of their mash, but the Czechs, it's sort of an unofficial their own sort of Reinheitsgebot kind of thing. It's not considered a Czech style lager if you're not pulling that decoction at least once. On my system, for what I want, I find that the double decoction is what works the best. Our anniversary beer is this is Patience and Fortitude. That one's called Patience and Gratitude. You know, just thank you for supporting us is kind of the idea. It's triple decocted, which is the very traditional way like Pilsner or Quell is done. It's a lot of labor, but it's a fun beer to make. And in this case, we're aging it in a fooder. That's a very large oak vessel that we purchased from Threes, who are they're one of the first breweries around. I mean, really one of the first breweries in the United States to really put a lot of effort into oak aging lager.
Their food or pills.
Yeah, exactly. So this was their fooder. They had a little bit of a reorganization and kind of had to close one of their spaces and they've sort of like moved things around. And so they were offloading this and I was like, well, I mean, I can't, this is an iconic fooder. If it's offered to me, I have to buy it. So I did. And so our first beer was also a triple decocted beer that went through there. It was a collaboration with Threes.
So New York City has come so far that there's already beer history from Threes, which started in like 2014 or something.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. But they're twice as old as us. So if not old, more than that. So,
So for him as a drinker, the difference between a double decoction and a triple decoction Czech style pills.
It's pretty subtle difference, but the difference between any kind of decoction and no decoction is pretty noticeable. You can't really fake that. And that's why I think the Czechs care so much about it. And for me, that mouthfeel is you can't beat that. I hear people, people tell me that they prefer German style, Pilsner because they feel like it's a little less like robust. It's a little more crisp. Like there's this tendency nowadays that everybody wants to call lager crisp. And if you're calling a Czech style lager crisp, you're probably not understanding what you're talking about.
You don't know the word crisp.
But because like, you know, it's like they have a pretty high finishing gravity. The Czechs say that that their traditional strains of yeast that come from Urquell, especially Urquell, they'll say this, they're lazy. The gravity's finish high, so the beer's finished a little sweet, but like you put a ton of hops in there to like offset that. They're low alpha acid hops, so they're not super bitter. So you just have to add. You're basically bittering with like high flavor hops. And that's just like how the beer is made, traditionally speaking, and how that character comes out.
Is that why you call it Patience?
Well, it's called Patience at 42 because it was the very first beer we ever canned, and we canned it in April 2020, and I said to my business partner Tyler, who names most of our beers, I was like, just give it a big name because this is like a Hail Mary to the universe, and please don't let us die before we even get started. So he was like, came up with this. And so Patience and Fortitude, for people who, like half the people listening will probably know, they're the lions that guard the New York Public Library. We give it, and I always like to have like a literary or cartographic or some sort of nerdy reference if possible, or punk rock reference. You know, those are the three places we usually go with our names. So
let's go. So Ted, the crisp, if I said crisp Pilsner, what's a crisp Pilsner? Do you have an example of one? Do you think of Pilsners as being crisp?
That's definitely one of the, one of the buzzwords people throw out there all the time.
It's a crispy boy.
Yeah. You know, it's the first one popped in my head, of course, is crisp from Six Point. Mm-hmm. But you know, like more the German, you know, German Pilsners, Kronbacher, Kolmbacher, you know, those types of Pilsners, those types of real German Pilsners. I'd say that's what I'm thinking about. What I'm thinking about, crisp.
Crispy boys. That's what I feel. This is what we're doing tonight. We're at the bar. We had the Roberta's Innerborough Hellas.
Yeah.
Was that crisp?
I think of Hellas more as being soft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did crisp become, is that what an Italian Pilsner is? Is an Italian style Pilsner crisp?
I think so. That being said, you know, yes, I would say probably, but it's such a young style.
Crispy Pilsner to me, it has to have bite and it has to have a sharp finish.
Yeah, yeah.
Without much of a, without much lingering there.
Right.
Whereas like the Czech style, it's much more raw and kind of rough. And it's definitely got that good ending bitterness, but it lingers for a while there, which is something that I really enjoy. I like Czech style Pilsners.
One thing I noticed when we were there is that, with the exception of like the industrial strength sort of like the Urquell that gets like shipped around the world, it's like, you know, fined and filtered and pasteurized, like there tends to be a little haze in the beers over in the pale lagers over there, and that you don't get in like the German styles. Those are expected to be pretty bright, and that to me like is a hallmark of it. I think of Czech style pale lager as a little bit more rustic than like a German beer. Another way that sets it apart.
You know, talking about traditions, a few years ago we had on the people from Coat, KOUT, that I know Shelton Brothers were importing. And they were one of the first kind of post-Soviet era Czech brewers that was being exported. And I wonder if the Soviet time kind of froze the brewing style over there. What do you think? Because it seemed like for a long time they may not have even been making beer.
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, I don't think they know. I don't know if we know.
I think they kept making like.
I think they did.
There's one thing the Soviet. There's one thing the people did behind the Iron Curtain is drink.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the Czechs drink beer.
Yeah.
I mean, they drink beer
more than anybody.
Yeah.
So we just didn't get it.
Well, we didn't get it. Yeah. Like it reminds me of when Goza came back and people started talking about Leipzig and Goza, and it's like, well, why is it salty? Well, because that's the water. They brackish water to brew with, and that's why. And now people are adding sea salt back into the brewing process.
Yeah.
When Leipzig, they wouldn't have made a brackish beer if they had a choice. They had to make it that way.
That's classic styles for you. Like the beer, the color of the beer and the historical styles because of the water. Like everything's because of the water. As they brew the water they had.
Right. And you brew with the ingredients you have.
Exactly. Yeah. Just so happens in the Czech Republic, you have like some of the best ingredients you can possibly get and some of the best water. But like, I mean, doesn't mean that that beer is any more special than like a London Porter or.
Well, to what Jimmy, one of the things that Jimmy was saying is that because of the freezing in time, and the Germans moved on, as you mentioned, the Germans are, you know, technologically a very, you know, and they're very precise and they're always looking to improve on things.
Yeah.
And in the breakup of the Soviet Union, they didn't have that, you know, we don't really know, but I don't think they really, I don't think they really had the opportunity to advance the technology in Czech Republic.
So that's why
they're still doing
it. It kind of makes sense because you didn't have like the post-World War II modernization of everything. And
That makes a lot of sense.
And I'm also glad you guys, on your own, without me prompting you, the big note for today was talk about classic styles.
Oh, yeah.
Guys like Jeff Alworth. I think classic styles never go away.
No.
And I'm always ready to drink one that I haven't had in a while. And I always think you're always going to have a rebirth with classic styles.
I'll probably make a bad reference here, but please understand what I'm getting at. It's like an Armani suit or a Tiffany diamond. Like, it's never going to go out of style. Maybe those are bad examples. Cause, like I said, I'm not very fashionable.
That's okay.
I mean, I think I'll say this as somebody who makes a lot of lager and makes a lot of English style ales right now. That's a tangent. Like, we have a really big cast program that's happening right now. But I see a lot of the breweries who have made a lot of IPA over the last 10 years are starting to make those kinds of beers to try to diversify things a little bit. And I feel very seen. I'll just say that.
Well, that's great. Cause I was starting to, and I know a lot of other beer guys that I've talked to over the last few years were just like, you know, I started to say, you know, we got out of when I found the world of craft beer and found beers that had flavor and different things. It was the only beers that were available were the same European lagers, American pale lagers. It was it. It was, you know, you went to a store and there were 15 or 20 different brands of beer that all tasted, you know, pretty much the same.
Totally.
And I started to feel the same way when I would go to a tap room and see, you know, different takes on four different hops for six different IPAs, hazies, then double IPAs, and you'd see one lager and one saison up there. And I'm like, come on, guys, let's, you know, there's a great big world out there, and, you know, let's get back to that. But
hey, so you switch this up. What's the next beer?
So this is Lucidity. This is our table beer. It's a quick 2 months in the fooder. It's a light little 100% New York ingredients. Little saison. It's can conditioned. Same as like you would bottle condition, but in cans. What we found, this is one of those modern things that I'm not necessarily in love with, but my job is to, besides make beer, is to sell beer. And so we found
that's on your business card.
It's not on my business card, but it's on my business plan, for whatever that's worth at this point. So what we found is we could have made this beer and put it in 500 milliliter bottles. We could put it in 750s and we could have watch it sit on shelves, but we put it in four packs. We take a hit on the margin and we watch it go out the door. If it sits in the food, if it only needs to sit in the fooder for 2 months, I can make this beer, you know, four times a year. It needs another month, say, in the can and keg to condition. But it's an easy beer to make. It's cheap on ingredients. It's a repitched yeast and bacteria culture, and you know, a quick can conditioning, you know, it doesn't take forever. It's just a nice, crisp, light little beer. This is the modern world where, you know, people want everything in cans, and so I'm meeting them halfway. It's can conditioned. It's re-fermented in the can. So when you poured it, it's mostly head to start because I tried to carbonate it like a Belgian style beer because it is, you know, so it's just a light, refreshing little beer that tart. It's what am I calling it now? 3.8%.
It's a perfect beer for today. It's
mid-90s
out there. Yeah. And absolutely brutal. And I could drink this all day.
My first taste, at first I thought it was a Goza because we were talking about Gozas. Yeah, yeah. I thought you were riffing on Ted.
No, just a little Saison.
I thought so too.
Yeah. Ted was so flattered. He's like, I meant, whatever I talk about, Brett's going to taste Goza. Then what's next, Ted?
It is. I've never made a Goza, actually. I've intended to, but we have a big Berliner Weiss program. One of our oak vessels is just basically dedicated to making no boil, like traditionally made Berliner Weiss. That, you know, another one of those modern things. I would like to put that beer out and make the syrups available, the Woodruff and the raspberry syrup. But you know what sells beer better? If I put like a combination of
fruit
in it and call it spritz, or put watermelon and lime in it and call it sandia. That sells really well. Actually, they're really good beer, so I enjoy making them. But like, you know, this is you have to like take your traditional take on beer, and you also have to like, it has to be modern. You can't just try to make like classic style for the sake of classic style. You root it in classic style and then you spin it forward. Patience and Fortitude, I'm not spinning it forward in any way. I'm trying to make like the most classic Czech style beer, but with a beer like, yeah, with those Berliner Weiss type beers, I would, you know, those we keep super so modern.
Styles evolve.
Right. So that's why I don't make a Goza.
The same as if there was probably a time when sugar was harder to get and more expensive, and I don't know, maybe it was 200 years ago, suddenly sugar wasn't as expensive. People started making jams. And
exactly.
Jams were considered a treat.
Yeah, totally.
Yep.
I don't know where that came from. I'm thinking, you know, when you talk about classic styles and you talk about Czech, I am going back in time. I'm thinking about that great book about pills that came out a couple years ago. It might have been Tom something. I can't even remember. Oh. I'm bad. He was on the show.
Okay.
But it's kind of talking about how it went from Germany to you know, to check and back and forth,
mm-hmm.
and those early styles, and I do wonder. I feel like right now everyone's in love with Czech style beers, and I love them. Notch Up in Massachusetts,
yeah.
You know, everyone's got a side pour is really sexy and a great way to drink beer,
yeah.
And you almost feel like you have to be thankful that the Czech Republic was in this little time capsule,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
You know, it could have just gone away.
Yeah.
And we see that with a lot of traditional styles. Let's go back to the Czech, because I didn't realize how much you were into the traditional Czech styles, Brett, and I'm really proud of you.
Yeah.
I find it, at least for conversation and drinking, it's good.
Absolutely.
More about these steps. Like,
yeah.
How sacred is your brewery? Like, that you just mentioned there's one place you're doing one vessels for Berliner Weiss.
Yeah.
How do you break that down? How do you treat the area around, you know, when you're fermenting the Czech style lagers?
Yeah, I mean,
is there like a nose, you know?
No. I mean, it's you know, we're in a 7,000.
You have to wear crosses.
And we're in a 7,000 square foot, you know, a New York City industrial space. So, you know, we're packed
cut
in.
Cut my finger and put a piece of blood in it every month.
There's a lot that we always joke about any beers we've made with Brettanomyces that there's Brett in that, and like, we're worried that people think I'd like put my hand in there and swirl it around.
Your blood.
That's right. It's my blood. It's not my hand. It's my blood. It's not to say sacred, it's hard to say. Like, the Berliner Weiss tank is that because, you know, it's sort of like with the mixed fermentation tanks, like once you have, especially I can turn a stainless tank back into a clean side tank with, you know, heavy chemicals and an autoclave. But once you put anything, any kind of wild yeast or bacteria into oak, it's there forever. So I have the one fooder, the threes fooder that's a dedicated lager fooder. Otherwise, like I have one that's dedicated to our flagship saison, contour interval, and one that's dedicated to that Berliner Weiss, which is kind of always keeps a foot in the sour game for us, because you know when times are lean, which they usually are. It's hard for me to make a lot of barrel-aged sour beer. It's, you know, it costs money. It's time intensive. It sits for a long time. Usually it needs to be fruited, which I wouldn't use purees for those types of beers. Fresh fruit's also expensive. And then I have to buy glass bottles. That's expensive. I have to pay two other people to help me bottle. That's expensive. So it's, So barrel-aged sour beer is something that doesn't get made quite as much as I would like to have. But the Berliner Weiss lets me have a sour beer on all the time that doesn't take as much labor and doesn't take as much effort to package. We keep them basically as draft only. And at the moment, they're mostly taproom only. We did release some in August. We said we weren't going to talk about sales, but August is very bad for beer sales in New York City. And we sent a bunch of stuff out to distribution because, like, yeah, just needed to get it out there. So as far as like the Czech stuff goes, like, it's a production brewery. So there might be a Czech style beer in a fermenter one day. And then the next week, 2 weeks later, there might be Italian Pilsner in there, or we do a Helles. We do German style lager as seasonals. We just don't have any flagships, and we've gotten into this hoppy lager thing, which I think allows us to use traditional techniques but make sort of really modern beers. I'm using a lot of IPA types of hops, but like with a very subtle hand, and so. Just trying to like push the envelope a little bit with that and see where we can go. And maybe I'll be able to quit making New England IPA entirely if people think my hoppy lagers check the box.
Trends change, classic right. Styles always come back. And exactly. Hey, you know, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City, Long Island, and Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Hey, you guys, support us, become a member at heritageradionetwork.org. Hey, it's so great to be back in the studio. We're at Roberta's Pizza indoors in the Heritage Radio Network studio that's been here since 2009. And big shout out again to Roberta's Pizza and Brendan Hoy. Thanks so much for supporting our network. And this to me, what do you guys think? I've got Brett Taylor from Wild East. And Ted Kenny from Top Ops. Isn't this the greatest place in the world to drink beer?
No, it's so fun.
Oh, yeah. It's such a great spot. And thanks, Armin's Benjamin, for being our engineer and keeping everything going. So we're talking about Wild East and Top Ops. And before we came in, we were sitting at the bar at Roberta's. They started talking about August sales. And, you know, it doesn't hurt to talk about trends. And in New York City, it seems that a lot of people go away in August. And, Ted, you've been capitalizing on that. You've got this little Top Pops. What's your take on it? Well, you've got a van that can go to parties and things.
Yeah, we've got a tap truck. It's an Italian Piaggio Ape, it's the same company that makes Vespa. And Vespa means wasp, and Ape means bee. So the Vespas are the sexy scooter, and
ask him, Brett, if he has one more beer. That was it. Okay.
And the Ape is basically, it's like the bumblebee next to the wasp. But it's you see these all over the place in Southeast Asia. They call them tuk-tuks, and call it a tuk-tuk because that's the sound the engine makes. Tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk. But you see them everywhere. You've seen them in movies. If you've ever been to Southeast Asia, you see them. They use them as cabs. They use them as trucks. They use them all kinds of, all kinds of industrial uses.
I'm asking because you're an innovative retailer, man.
Right. So we
went from bottle shop to this market bar, and now you're doing portable bars.
Right. So we took one of these tuk-tuks. We put a box on the back of it with a refrigeration and a tap system. And we've got six taps on it. And we do mostly parties at people's houses and some corporate gigs and some private clubs.
Would they put it on a trailer and drop it off?
I actually pull it into the back of my Dodge ProMaster van. In fact, Jimmy, you saw my van.
That's outside.
It's inside the van right now.
It's that small.
Wow. It's that small. Yes. It's 4.5 feet wide, 9 feet long, and I can fit it inside the van.
That's amazing.
We've been having a lot of fun with it. It was part of the COVID pivot and, trying to go where the customers are and trying to bring, we want to bring the tap room to your backyard. And so we can have six different beers. We can have wine and beer. We can have wines. We can have draft cocktails. Whatever you need.
So there's one more step from being a bottle shop and delivering for a party. You can actually
bring
that
in
and have a party at the little van.
You can rent us out. You can have a bunch of Wild East beers on tap at your at your party.
And when I get rich.
It's not that much.
Yeah, yeah.
It's surprisingly accessible.
How do we find out about that one? Because I know it's Top Hops, but what is that called again?
It's on the Top Hops website or the tophops.com or the Top Hops Instagram page.
That's great.
At Top Hops.
And then Brett, another beer. So the whole point of today is I wanted to hang out with you, hear where you're at, and taste your beers.
Yeah. So So this is three of my four sort of like I've actually three of my four kind of like where we are with beer at the moment, and this is our West Coast, our first West Coast pale ale. We do a lot of West Coast IPA, as I mentioned, but this is our first pale ale. It's a fun little Centennial Chinook Strata and Cashmere beer. And it's I just wanted to make those classic pale ale that we sort of grew up with, but a little bit of a modern spin on it.
It's great, man. Thank I'm you. Loving it. Cheers.
Yeah.
And again, we started talking about things like crispy and other things. What are people asking for when they go into a tap room these days?
I mean,
do they want to try a lot of things still?
They do, yeah. But like, I mean, our top selling beers are usually, if I look at any given day, it's usually, sometimes on Saturdays, it's the New England IPA. But typically, it's like, it's patience and fortitude. Our Italian Pilsner, La Ultima Moda, which we have most of the time. And then it's some combination of like Czech style pils, Italian pils, West Coast IPA, one or two of the mixed fermentation beers. I say that's probably our top five. it's a nice mix. I'm seeing the beers that I want people to have. It's not like I'm trying to push everybody in a certain direction by like making a lot of English style beers and traditional style beers, and they're not selling, and everybody's just going for that hazy beer anyway. There are times that that is the top selling beer, but it's usually going to be like that mug of Patience and Fortitude, that golden, beautiful beer with that like big, like three or four fingers of head on top of it. And they're like, I want that. Or they'll see like one of our various, pink sour beers. And they're like, yeah, I want that. So a lot of it is people see the beer, it sells itself.
Yeah. And then for you, Brett, you know, now that you guys have been open, what is it, four years? Just about 4 years now? Three, 4 years?
Going on 50. I guess 2020, we'll call it 2020, call three. We're going to celebrate our third anniversary. Grand anniversary three. It's coming up in October. So
that's great, man.
Yeah.
And you're in a special part of Brooklyn right near.
Yeah.
Do you call it Gowanus still where you are?
Yeah, it's still Gowanus, yeah. It's changing massively. By
three's other half and yeah. Finback Brooklyn.
Yeah, and Stronger Up, the original location. Yeah. It's been rezoned, so there are probably, somebody told me 80,000 units worth of 80,000 units of new housing
being built
at the moment. Yeah, residential. Yeah. Whoa. Yeah, they rezoned almost all the M zone got turned into mixed use. So we have, if you walk any direction from our space, you'll hit like 5 to 10 construction sites within 5 minutes. Like there are so many buildings going up. It's crazy.
So I guess you can say you got in early.
Yeah. I don't think anybody else can get in there because I think I've heard like 40 a foot is the going rate for people trying to get spaces and like, yeah, that's not, we would have never signed for 40 a foot. We would not be in that neighborhood.
And then Brett, going back, you know, it seems not that long ago, but it seemed that the path to becoming a brewer in New York City used to be you got involved as a home brewer, got involved in competitions.
Yeah.
And now, is that still the case? Or do you feel like that there's opportunities for people to just jump in and start interning at a brewery?
So I had an assistant brewer for a while. She moved on. She's great. She never homebrewed in her life. She came in as a bartender, and basically said, I'm interested in learning the production side of things. And I was like, sure. She had had a little bit of experience, elsewhere and, gave her the opportunity. And she just grew into the role and just kept getting better and better and learning more and more. And same with our sales rep, our who's, you know, basically brand ambassador, head of sales, and our head of logistics. I know he's a jack of all trades guy. All three of them started as bartenders and during COVID, and we needed a lot of other roles filled. They requested. They said what they wanted to do, and we gave them the opportunity, and all of them flourished. So I think that there's a lot of ways into these jobs, and I think it's just – I think a lot of times a foot in the door, a good work ethic, and just
– you know, you're a small business, but what are some of the jobs that people can do on the brewery side and the production side?
You mean in terms of just in general?
At a small brewery like yours, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people probably start in on the packaging side of things. Like you help with like canning day. A lot of people bring in mobile canners, and so you know the mobile canners, they get the beer from your tank into the can. It's your responsibility to catch the can, and then you know put the pack techs on it, put it in the trays, and then palletize. But there's a lot more to it than that. And so somebody might start doing that, but then they might learn about like how to, you know, dial in the carbonation. There's a lot of like micromanagement it needs to go on a canning day. And then a lot of these breweries then upgrade into getting their own canning line. So you might go that direction. So you can just be in packaging all the time. A lot of people starting to sell it as well. So my former assistant, she started, on packaging. Then she moved into the cellar, and then she moved into brewing. More mistakes can happen on the packaging side on the cellar side than in actual brewing. But, it's kind of weird that people start in that, but just, this is how the industry works. And, I would say to answer your question most succinctly, it's you start in packaging, start in cellar, start in brewing. And then of course there's like sales, marketing, doing the whole sort of, social media aspect of this is not easy. It takes a special skill, and I don't know what that is.
But for the beer side, it's packaging, cellaring, and brewing.
Yeah, that's probably in the broadest strokes, yeah. And there's also like the warehousing and logistics, which is very important.
And then, Ted, to wrap it up, for you, and I'm going to say old days because old days it was different. If you had a beer bar, part of what always happened was that a brewery was trying to get a tap on your draft system. And what does it take? Is that still, do you feel that it's a make or break for certain breweries to be on your tap system? Or what does it take to get on your tap system?
It definitely used to be make or break. When we opened up Top Hops in 2012, we fully expected the growler business, because growlers hadn't even come out yet.
Yeah.
We fully expected the growler business to be an enormous part of our, it's like you were saying earlier with the sales plan, it's like, or the business plan, it's like, throw that out.
Yep.
Almost immediately, the mobile canning unit came into bay. And I remember when, there was a couple of guys that came in from one of the early mobile canning places, and they're explaining what they were doing. And I was like, wow, you guys are going to go gangbusters.
Yeah.
And I had,
and they did.
I only had an inkling of what they were going to actually end up doing. And back in 2012 and before that, the only way craft beer, you sold it by the glass or you sold it by the keg.
Yeah.
And there was no other way to sell it.
Yeah.
And so growlers, had begun to be a big thing. But really there were only a few, especially in New York, there were only a few places that were filling growlers at bars, and there were really only a handful of breweries in New York at the time.
Yeah.
It
seems quaint now, doesn't it? That you could go to your tab and go home. You'd have a branded growler in your refrigerator 3 days later, and
big glass jug. You open that thing back up, you pour it, and you go, it's all flat.
Yeah. You drink 64 ounces all in one seating, or
right? Everybody would buy a growler.
I got the branded growler.
Everybody would grab a growler. They'd say,
I can't believe we're talking about this, and some of our listeners to even think that this was people used to actually line up for this stuff.
Yeah, and people would always ask, how long does it keep? And I'm like, it'll keep about 3 or 4 days if you don't open it.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
Yeah.
And then they're like, but what if I have a beer and then put it back? I'm like, no, that's like, it's like putting back a Pepsi can.
Yeah.
It's not
exactly.
It's going flat fast.
And oxidized.
Yeah. And it's just not.
I used to have like 20. I have one now, and it's, This is a shout out to all the OG people. It's Beercraft. That's the one I own. I would never lose that one.
That's awesome. I'm the pack rat that can't throw these things away.
Oh,
so
gosh.
I still have.
You just save stuff. In 50 years, it'll be considered important.
I have one from Shanghai,
yeah.
And I just can't let that go. Box and Cat Brewery in Shanghai.
Oh, wow.
And I've got a few others, and I just can't let them go.
I was gonna say,
I think I actually rinsed out a couple of them.
It's nice. It's a touch the surface on what's going on. Wild East is doing Czech style pills, man. And I'm so happy for you. And Ted's doing mobile bar, but we're still talking about growlers.
Yeah, I know.
And it doesn't seem like that long ago.
A lot of gray hair in this room.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I just want to say thanks so much, Brett from Wild E's and Ted from Top Ops. Thanks so much for coming out here, Roberta's. We might stay and have a pizza together, hang out. And yeah. Big shout out, Armin Spengen, our engineer. Thanks so much. 14 years, Beer Sessions Radio, Heritage Radio Network. Thanks so much. We'll catch you next time. All right.
Woo.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.